This week, Darren Lehners dives into the seventh question of Whither Are We Traveling? Do we pay enough attention to the festive board? Does your lodge know the difference between a festive board and a table lodge? If the answer is they're the same thing, I'm sorry to tell you, that's just not true. We'll break apart the differences. We'll talk about the necessity for the festive board, one of Freemasonry's fundamental tools for making this world a better place by making good men better. Then we'll hear the tale of Nathaniel Beverly Tucker as illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison takes us through this week's Masonic Minute, a troubled past grandmaster moving from Christian denomination to Christian denomination due to his dubious beliefs. Did Nathaniel Beverly Tucker plan the entire secession of the South? Well, you'll have to listen to find out. Finally, we'll wrap it up with a single tarot card draw. We'll be working with the coveted Manly P. Hall and J.A. Knapp tarot deck. Are you strong-willed, bold, and ready to execute on challenges? Find out. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 537. Right away, I want to thank all of our supporters, those contributors, fellows, producers, and of course, our legacy partners for making this show possible. I also want to thank everybody out there, whether you were a past supporter or a current supporter, it doesn't matter. You have played an integral role in this program, and we could not have done it without you. Thank you once again. I also want to thank everybody out there who shares the program with their lodge brothers, their families who are interested in the craft, and just in general, everybody who supports the push for more Masonic education. If you're listening to this on Monday, that means this evening I'll be doing a presentation, The Legend of Adam's Grave. I'll be doing it virtually for Recovery Lodge number 31 in Greenville, South Carolina. Then I've got a little bit of a break until sometime, I think April 20th, we're doing a great table lodge for Cary Grove Lodge here in Illinois, and that'll be a lot of fun. Just want to let everybody know, some people are interested and they're following some of the other things that I'm involved with, one of which is a really fun podcast I do. I co-host actually with Brother Darren Lehners from the Meet, Act, and Part podcast. He and I both are fans of the mystery stuff. About a year ago, we started a podcast called Beyond the Fourth Veil, and it goes by seasons, and so we completed season one, which consisted of five episodes. You know, we really weren't sure how long we were going to be able to do the podcast. We both found it a lot of fun to be able to talk about some of the things that are not generally considered, you know, they're not Masonic, they're not really just a cult, you know, they're kind of outside the realm of some of those things, and we recognize other people are into it also, so we invite you to check out Beyond the Fourth Veil. It's a YouTube show, just Darren and I talking about various topics. You know, episode one was sightings. We had Ben Williams on to talk with Darren and myself about when Ben and I basically went to Skinwalker Ranch. We had an episode on cryptids, on ghost hunting, encounters. We just started season two, where we did an episode about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. And we just wrapped an episode on Travis Walton. So that'll be a really cool episode to check out if you're interested in some pretty hair-raising conspiracies. We're going to get into that in that particular episode. So, speaking of Darren Lehners, I wanted to go ahead and let's get into the piece this week that we're going to read. We're continuing his look at Whither Are We Traveling, Part 8, which is a take on Dwight L. Smith's work that he published. It's gotten rave reviews the last 60 years. And in fact, there is a response to the piece that he wrote entitled Laudable Pursuit, which was published by the Knights of the North. And you can get that book through lulupress.com. There's links to it on our website, wcypodcast.com, if you're having trouble finding it, but you shouldn't. And there's also a free PDF version of it out there, too, if you don't care to have it in print. The cool thing, though, too, is if you want, you can actually get Laudable Pursuit as an audiobook through Audible. And it is read by the Masons of Space Novum Lodge, 1183. And all of the proceeds of that go right into the Indiana Masonic Museum and Library. So not $1 is kept by us, right? It all goes over to there. That was Chris's request, and we are happy to honor it. Let's get into this. Whither Are We Traveling? Part 8. As we continue to explore Dwight L. Smith's seminal work, Whither Are We Traveling?, we begin to explore his answers to the 10 questions he posed for self-examination of the state of ancient craft Freemasonry in 1963. The questions he asked are as important and relevant now as they were then. This week, we look at question 7. Do we pay enough attention to the festive board? This is a huge question. I'm breaking away from the article for just a moment to talk about the festive board. Now, the festive board and the Table Lodge are two very and distinctly different things. Many Grand Lodges do not recognize the difference, or they don't recognize one or the other, or sometimes they amalgamate both of them. Now, the festive board is nothing more than a dinner with Freemasons being present. Sometimes there are toasts given, but generally there's no actual Masonic secret stuff happening. Anybody can come to a festive board, prospective candidates, upstanding members of the community, and then you've got the actual table lodge, which is a table lodge, which usually is tiled or has people who are only Masons in attendance. Oftentimes the charter is displayed, and there are times when a Grand Lodge has a prescribed manner in which a table lodge is to be run, but they don't have any say technically over a festive board because it is not a Masonic meeting. It is just a dinner where Masons are present and celebrating Masonry. That's just my take. Of course, any grand jurisdiction, any grand master will have their own take on the situation. But let's get into the piece. Most Worshipful Brother Smith begins this section with an examination of how Pisgah Lodge at Corydon was less than a month old when the time came to celebrate the Feast of St. John the Baptist in 1817. He states that there was every reason for them not to observe the holiday, having little money and having the brethren busy with their normal occupations. However, he states that the minutes tell a tale of a small number of Freemasons who assembled and marched to the courthouse to hear an oration, and after that, they marched to a local establishment and partook of dinner. He goes on to mention that the lodge records of any lodge that was around at that time or before will describe similar events, and that if there were minutes or secretary records about the amount spent on that jug of whiskey, we chuckle and explain to ourselves that times, quote-unquote, were different then. He agrees that times were different, but states he's not convinced that change has been for the better. He then goes on to state that, quote, should any reader have to ask what the festive board is, that in itself will serve to show how far we have strayed from the traditional path of Freemasonry, end quote. The problem is that, while every lodge eats now and then, that is just the problem. We eat, he asks. But how often the brethren are permitted to meet around the festive board for the genuine heartwarming fellowship of the traditional Masonic feast, the same kind of close-knit community of interest that a family experiences when it gathers for Thanksgiving dinner? He states that, for the most part, lodges have abandoned the festive board, and goes on to quote a passage from H.L. Haywood's book, More About Masonry, extolling the virtues of a festive board and how, when fellowship is restored, brotherly love will follow and that members will fill up the empty lodge rooms. He then goes on to ask, what has happened? His answers are, quote, first of all, we must not underestimate the Puritan influence on American Freemasonry. It is that influence which, almost without our knowing it, attaches some sort of holier-than-thou stigma to our hour of refreshment, frowns upon anything cheerful and festive, and gives us that grim and silent staring at a wall of which Haywood speaks. How many times have you heard a pious brother refer sneeringly to the knife and fork Mason and to the 630 degree, as if there might be something reprehensible in the enjoyment of fellowship? How silly can we become? The brethren are not going to fill the benches until the walls bulge just to see the pious brother clown his part in the Master Mason degree, and why should they? For some reason, Freemasonry overseas was able to escape the more sour effects of Puritanism. But on almost every facet of American life, we still suffer from it. The ramifications of its influence on Freemasonry in the United States are far too numerous and controversial to discuss here, and I must not elaborate on the subject except to say that a great many of our problems today can be traced back to the period when it was deemed almost mortal sin to eat, drink, and be merry. While most worshipful Brother Smith feels that discussing this is controversial, I have no problem with saying what I feel on the subject. In my grand jurisdiction of Illinois, alcohol isn't allowed on the property of or inside the lodge building. Maybe your jurisdiction is different. This being said, in a previous piece, we discussed the appendant bodies and how there is often a rush of men to get into these bodies and forego that Blue Lodge experience altogether. I have no doubts that alcohol being allowed at the meetings of some of these appendant bodies is a factor in that. How many times do we hear members repeat the old, tried and true saying, we take good men and make them better? If this is really the case, if we are good men, then why do a majority of our grand lodges forbid alcohol in the lodge building? Let me be perfectly clear. I am not advocating for open containers of alcohol in the lodge room, nor am I advocating for them to be a part of a stated meeting. What I am saying is that if we are good men, then we should be treated as adults and allowed to use our own God-given judgment on how to act in our lodge buildings. Point of order, isn't it part of the junior warden's duties to see that none convert the means of refreshment into intemperance or excess? Why would this line be included if there wasn't a time in our history when alcohol wasn't frowned upon? Should the brethren want to have a glass of wine at dinner prior to the meeting, or have a drink after the meeting, this should be allowed. We need to allow the junior warden to do his job and superintend the brethren during this time, and if we are good men, then we will act responsibly. Speaking about tradition, the traditional festive board and even the ritual I have for the table lodge in Illinois has toasts. While you don't necessarily need to have alcohol to toast, traditionally the toast is done with an alcoholic beverage. It seems counterintuitive for a grand jurisdiction to publish a ritual for a table lodge, include toasts in the ritual, and then ask brethren to use sparkling grape juice. If we want to regain some of our former glory, then I would state that having festive boards in our own lodge buildings is a way to do this, and allowing alcohol to be a part of them is allowing us to practice fellowship in the ways that our foreign brethren do, where this is not an issue whatsoever. Only in America do we seem to have these vestiges of the temperance movement haunt our hallowed halls. Enough already. 2. We must remember that this is the day of the service club. And, like it or not, our beloved fraternity has members by the thousands who think Freemasonry should be made over to fit the Babbitt pattern, the glad handling and first naming the perfunctory first stanza of America, and the perfunctory Pledge of Allegiance, the raucous laughter, the ribald stories, the movies showing how corn plasters are manufactured. That kind of thing carried into Freemasonry becomes a travesty on Masonic fellowship. But it has crept into our lodges, and we might as well face up to it. End quote. How true is it that we have adopted patterns found in other organizations all for the so-called betterment of Freemasonry? We want to be too many things to too many people. We have lost our sense of identity. And with it, our purpose, because we are trying to please everyone. For an organization that holds so fast to our ancient landmarks, we somehow have lost how our forefathers met. And instead of holding fast to those traditions, we have decided that we need to reinvent ourselves to keep up with the times. So, we have reached a point where Freemasonry is trying to be something it is not. We are not a service club, and we should stop pretending to be. Our charity should be first and foremost toward ourselves, our families, our widows and orphans. We need to invest in our membership and our own charities instead of investing in public charities thinking that they will buy us goodwill, publicity, or more members. We are a fraternity, and we need to start acting like one by allowing festive boards with all of their trappings in our lodge buildings. While Masonic scholars opine and gnash their teeth about why millennials and Gen Z are not joining our fraternity, the answer to me is pretty clear. These generations value authenticity. How can we wonder why they are not joining us when we can't be authentic as an organization ourselves? And, on the off chance we do get a new member, how quickly we run them off by having a majority of our membership not live up to the ideals inculcated into them during their degrees. We are our own worst enemy. Imagine their disappointment when they come to their first meeting. Here's an unfortunate but familiar scenario. They sit down to a dinner of cold cuts, cheese, chips, and stale bread. Or if they're really lucky, a warm meat dish served with green beans and another side. They sit through a dinner where they listen to their brethren discuss politics and or religion, topics that they thought were forbidden to be discussed in a lodge. On the off chance they have enough courage to question this, they are quickly informed that the rule only applies between the gavels. After dinner, they sit through a poorly run business meeting where they are thrown into a chair without any explanation of what they are supposed to do, forced to listen to grown men argue about roof repairs and other banalities, followed by a past master who then comes over to instruct them in what they did wrong, often in front of other brethren as they shuffle out of the lodge room. We must, as Right Worshipful Brother Thomas Jackson states, return to the premise of making good men better through a viable educational process so that at least our membership comprehends our purpose. We also must embrace our heritage and work towards a common goal of changing Grand Lodge constitutions to allow festive boards to once again grace our buildings and with them the fellowship that they bring. 3. The casual living of our day. By this, I mean the dress of the cookout supper, the manners of the truck stop cafe. No lodge can experience the true joys of the festive board unless the brethren are willing to adopt some of the ways of civilization. Hard words, perhaps, but they need to be spoken. While most worshipful Brother Smith is only discussing festive boards, and maybe it's only something that happens in the Midwest, how many times have you shown up to a degree to see brethren in what could only be called their barn or beach clothes? When the candidate sees this, what do you think he thinks? If we don't dress or act accordingly, how can we expect the candidate to take our degree seriously? Our behavior and manner of dress should reflect the solemnity of our ceremonies. 4. The overemphasis on togetherness. I approach the subject with fear and trembling. Togetherness is to be encouraged, but it cannot be carried too far, and it has been carried too far in Freemasonry. In characteristic Midwestern style, we have gone overboard. Instead of inviting the ladies' auxiliaries and the junior divisions to meet in our quarters and pursuing our own ways with dignity and restraint, we have literally abdicated in favor of the family idea. Masonic fellowship has been one of the casualties. I am all for family events, however, I agree with most worshipful Brother Smith. We have to allow our members to have their own celebrations. We need to have our own opportunities for true Masonic fellowship. These are our opportunities for brethren to learn from each other's life experiences and enjoy each other's company. This is something that cannot be accomplished while wives and children are underfoot. Most worshipful Brother Smith continues with his own answers to the question he posed. Then where do we go from here? Well, first of all, we need to regain a sense of balance. For many Masons, fellowship is the most precious jewel in the Masonic diadem. It is necessary to the very existence of our fraternity. If brethren cannot find it in their ancient craft lodge, they will find it elsewhere, and the officers and workers who howl to high heaven when new members desert their lodge in favor of appendant organizations might reflect on the fact that brethren simply may be in search of that which the lodge denies them. We need to cultivate Masonic fellowship with all our zeal, not to choke it with our trivialities, nor speak of it with supercilious scorn. We need the hour of refreshment in all its beauty and dignity. We need to revive those noble old traditions of our craft. We haven't outgrown them. We haven't found anything better. We have lost something and haven't discovered what is wrong. As I alluded to earlier in this article, one of the major reasons we see new members flock to appendant bodies and never return to the Blue Lodge is because alcohol is allowed at their meetings. They seek out Masonic fellowship because the Blue Lodge experience has little to none to offer them. I cannot phrase it any better than what most worshipful Brother Smith says when he states, quote, "We need to cultivate Masonic fellowship with all our zeal, not to choke it out with trivialities, nor speak of it with supercilious scorn. We need the hour of refreshment in all its beauty and dignity. We need to revive those noble old traditions of our craft." End quote. But if the festive board is to serve its purpose, it must be dignified. I have said it before, and I repeat, a Masonic gathering is neither the proper time nor place for dirty language or suggestive stories. And just as lacking in propriety is the sectarian preaching and the rabble-rousing and the political speech disguised as quote-unquote Americanism. The lodge building needs to be treated as a sacred space and kept distant from the concerns of the profane world. As I alluded to above when discussing a not-so-hypothetical scenario of that first meeting after a candidate is raised as the Tyler guards against cowans and eavesdroppers, we should be guarding against topics that are divisive within our sacred halls. If we are to have festive boards, then they must not devolve into allowing topics of conversation that keep harmony from being the strength and support of our institution. Not only this, but in previous articles I have addressed how solemnity should be the number one priority of our candidate degrees. There is no room for ad-libbing, joking around, or horseplay. We need to treat the festive board as such. 3. The festive board must be appropriate. It is not an occasion for comedians, nor variety shows, nor vaudeville troupes, nor tap dancers or magicians, barbershop quartets, homegrown movies, cute little child entertainers. They have their place. But their place is at the family night party, not at the festive board of Freemasonry. We cannot realize the byproducts of Masonic fellowship when the stage setting is so inappropriate as to be ridiculous. I agree, again, but I think most worshipful Brother Smith could have included this in the above section. Clowns belong in the circus, not at a festive board. Unless you are a shrine clown, in which case you can enjoy the festivities. I only ask that you do not wear your makeup or outfit. The festive board should be treated with dignity and respect. This means that we need to dress accordingly, we need to serve proper feast, and we need to have proper toasts. Anything less is not worth the energy to plan and execute such an event. 4. And finally, the festive board must be Masonic. Repeatedly, I am invited to lodge banquets to deliver an address. Quote, give us one of those straight-from-the-shoulder Masonic speeches, they tell me in advance. We want you to lay it right on the line. And then, lo and behold, when I arrive to deliver that so-called Masonic speech and lay it on the line to the brethren, I find the room half-filled with ladies and children. Bless them. I love them, too. But let's acknowledge the most basic of all basic fundamentals. Freemasonry is for Freemasons. Surely a few occasions can be set aside in the annual program of a lodge when Master Masons can enjoy the fellowship to which they are entitled in a manner consistent with the traditions and practices of our ancient craft. I hope to see the day when the Table Lodge is authorized in Indiana as it has been in older jurisdictions for 2 centuries and more. I hope to see the day when every lodge takes pride in an appropriate observance of feasts of the Saints John, something more imaginative than the tedious routine of the Master Mason degree with donuts and coffee afterwards. Yes, and I hope to see the day when a Master Mason in the United States will have an occasion to sing of his lodge with the same depth of feeling that Robert Burns felt when he sang of his Oft Have I Met Your Social Band and Spent the Cheerful Festive Night, oft honored with supreme command, presided o'er the sons of light, and by that hieroglyphic bright which none but craftsmen ever saw, strong memory on my heart shall write these happy scenes when far away. I feel that this is a repeat of his point 4 above, the overemphasis of togetherness, so I shall repeat what I said in reply to it. We have to allow our members to have their own celebrations. We need to have our own opportunities for true Masonic fellowship. These are opportunities for brethren to learn from each other's life experiences and enjoy each other's company. This is something that cannot be accomplished while wives and children are underfoot. In my next article, I will explore the next question most worshipful Brother Smith poses, which is question 8. What has become of that course of moral instruction veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols that Freemasonry is supposed to be? Darren A. Laners, Past Master. This piece is, it's one of those ones where it lays it on the line, doesn't it? I'm not sure in which jurisdictions that they outright ban the festive board. Maybe they're only allowed to have table lodges. I'm left wondering what Grand Lodge feels that they have the right to tell a group of Masons they're not allowed to meet outside the lodge together to have lunch or dinner. And if you kind of have a festive board during that, that's nobody's business. But I digress. The land of the free, the home of the brave. Anyway, so we have here the difficult conversation, I think, that Darren brings up here is the allowing of spirits at a festive board if the festive board is held within the lodge. Here in Illinois, as he says, we don't allow any booze in the building. However, there is a stipulation to which it is allowed. You have to have a certain type of insurance, and the Grand Lodge has outlined this in previous administrations. If you're an Illinois Mason listening to this, and this is like shocking and you want to know more, you're going to need to write the Grand Secretary and the Grand Master for their interpretation of that code, because I'm not sure if they have updated that or not. However, I do feel that we should have our festive boards at every occasion. Every meeting, really, should have the festive board. A lot of us, you know, we meet before a meeting and we have dinner, and then you go to the meeting and then you all, you know, have drinks afterwards, and it kind of breaks up the night. It's nice. However, our festive board, if you really want to think about it, I mean, if your lodge is truly meeting just that one time a month, right? Space Nova meets once a month for 10 months a year. We don't eat before our meetings, so we always have a festive board afterward, and we never don't have it. In fact, sometimes we have to cut short in order to meet our reservation time at a restaurant to have our festive board, and then we continue the education over the meal, right? Because the festive board is important. The importance of the festive board cannot be overstated. I hope you guys listening out there, if you've never been to a festive board, maybe this is something that you can bring up as you go through the line at your lodge. Maybe start prepping for the time that your worshipful master, and you can implement the festive board and maybe start a new old tradition. For our Craftsman Plus, I would love to know if your lodge holds a festive board, whether that's just the annual, you know, festive board for the Lodge of the Saints John, or if you celebrate Feast of St. Andrew, or maybe you guys do a festive board after every meeting. What do you guys do? Are you even allowed to have festive boards? Does your Grand Lodge confuse the festive board with a table lodge? I'd love to hear what your thoughts about the festive board are. And we'll post that in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group for all of our supporters of the show. Now, let's get into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
Freemasonry is an organization that strives to make good men better. But we are all human, and sometimes things don't go as planned. One such brother who may not have lived up to our expectations was Nathaniel Beverly Tucker. He was born in Virginia in 1784. He studied law at William and Mary College before moving to St. Louis in 1815, where he became a lawyer and circuit court judge. He also served on the board of directors of the Bank of St. Louis, and in 1821, he was elected the second Grand Master of Missouri, eventually serving four terms. In 1833, Tucker moved back to his home state and became a law professor at William and Mary College in Williamsburg, Virginia, serving in that position for the remainder of his life. A Southern sympathizer, in 1837, Tucker penned a two-volume novel, The Partisan Leader, which predicted the secession of the Southern states and formation of the Confederacy. The seditious book, meant only to be distributed in Southern states, was published in secret and later banned. Dying in 1851 at the age of 67, Brother Tucker never really lived to see the events leading up to the Civil War. But years later, critics characterized the book as clearly mapping out the entire program of the secession of 1861 as accurately as if Brother Tucker had been in the confidence of the leaders of that movement a full 24 years after he wrote the book. Even most worshipful Brother Tucker's Masonic biography describes him as eccentric. It reports he kept his library in the stump of a hollow tree in Florissant, Missouri, and was known to go completely off his rocker when he once made the preposterous claim that slaves were happier than white people in menial factory jobs. Although reported to be a devout Presbyterian, Tucker was also regarded as a ladies' man and partygoer. He had three wives. After 18 years of marriage, his first wife, Mary Coulter, died in 1827. A year later, he married Eliza Naylor, who died just 5 months after the wedding. In 1830, after another year of playing the field, the 46-year-old Tucker married Lucy Ann Smith, the 17-year-old daughter of a friend. The age difference between the two was pretty wide, but that was more common in those days. Whether because of his reputation as a philanderer, or because of his excessive partying, or because of his support of slavery, or all three, the Presbyterian Church sanctioned him in 1831 for unchristian conduct. Testimony against him included the accusation that, on at least three separate occasions, he partook of the shocking amusement of dancing. There is no record of any additional action taken against him, but shortly thereafter, Brother Tucker became an Episcopalian. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
Natty T. That's pretty scandalous stuff. One would argue that the tenets of Freemasonry have, you know, remained the same since the 1700s, and yet somebody like this who comes in and still holds these kind of racial beliefs, not only that, but his, I guess, debaucherous character is very unbecoming of a Mason. I would stand to say that it probably wouldn't last long in today's society, although I had a chuckle when he was charged with witnessing dancing. Of all the things, you know, one wonders, is this, a gentleman's club where there are scantily clad persons, or is this a vaudeville act with a woman singer, as it were, in the Old West and Victorian era? What are we talking about here? And we really don't know, but certainly in the eyes of his religious establishment, it was a bit too far. We got to thank illustrious Brother Steve Harrison for bringing this one to us. Fascinating as always. Please check out his YouTube channel, The 1 Minute Mason. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Whence Came You, where all of our podcasts are published as well. And we've got the Masonic Minutes there all set up for you in a playlist so that you can set that up and click play for your next lodge event or, you know, a family night or something and just have it playing, or even at a convention somewhere. People can have a little sit, relax, have a drink, and watch those while they're taking a break from presenters or whatever else. If you enjoy that content, I would also ask you to check out Steve's books, which are available on Amazon, and we've got hot links to all of those right on our site in the bookstore, wcypodcast.com/the-bookstore. All right. But as we go to wrap it up this week, I did promise that we would pull a card. If you've been following us on TikTok, we're doing a little behind the scenes here and there. And this week, I announced that we would be doing a random tarot card draw from a special deck. Now, every tarot deck is special. I picked this deck up when I was at the Philosophical Research Society back in 2017, 2018. I was there on a small retreat. And in between some meditations and things, I walked over to the bookstore, which happened to be open, and I picked up a revised tarot deck by Knapp and Hall. So it's the Knapp Hall deck. I understand that these are pretty coveted right now. I'm not sure why they're out of print or whatever, but they are quite interesting cards. Knapp had all the awesome work that he did for The Secret Teachings of All Ages. People really love that book. I think it's a fantastic book. I wish it had more citations and references, but that is always the big ask, I guess. It's a standard card deck, 78 cards. I'm going to split it into four small piles and shuffle them all together. Is there a reason for that? Nope, just what was comfortable for me. And recently, some people ask questions about tarot, even amongst brothers of the craft. And also those out there who just might be into tarot, there still seems to be some, well, confusion about the tarot. I joked on the Winding Stairs Facebook group that I found a piece of artwork that was a tarot card, and it was a stack of pancakes, and it was called The Stack. And I thought it was just funny, and I said, hey, who says tarot is not Masonic, right? Because the pancake connection. And it was intended as a joke, however, I had a lot of people asking some serious questions on there about tarot. And I thought before I drew the card this week, I would let you guys know exactly what those questions were and talk about those just a little bit. So for those of you who are just joining us for the first time or maybe haven't heard of this, this is a section of the podcast that I just kind of indulge in a little bit. I put in this little section at the end called, you know, it's Reflections on the Tarot. And I'm not doing anything that, like, divines the future or conjures up spirits or anything like that. My purpose in work with the tarot is always a reflective and intuitive psychological tool. I don't consider it, you know, manifesting of anything in particular until it gets into the discovery of what's in your own subconscious. So actually, I said it was called The Stack. It was the tower, right? It's the key 16, the tower, but it was like a stack of pancakes. So two of the questions that were asked, one said, Mr. Johnson, a serious question. Does the fact that you are into the tarot mean you accept there is a direct connection between this dimension and the others? I believe in synchronicity, and I feel the effect of this dimensional crossover every day. I am suggesting once you train yourself to notice the tears, the cards become irrelevant. Only my opinion. So these questions are very, I don't know how to say it, like etheric in the way they're asked. So I said, hey, brother, let me rephrase your question to what I think you're asking. And I said, you're asking me if my belief and usage of tarot confirms a direct connection with various dimensions or realities. I said, the tarot for me isn't used in the way you allude to. For me, it's purely psychological, used for the inner guidance that comes from contemplation of the ascribed and sometimes interpreted meanings of the cards. I believe in David Bohm's implicate order theory. With this, you could say that the link between tarot and what you're asking is that I do believe introspection leads to manifestation and an understanding of how to make the world better for everyone. So when he asks about dimensions or realities, I kind of think about that in terms of possible outcomes and manifestation. That was one question. Another one, somebody had said, I once read that the Templars introduced the tarot in Europe. They used the pictures and symbols to communicate their stories because most people weren't able to read. That's just not true. And no harsh on that brother who heard that or read that. It's not good, accurate information. In fact, the tarot, there's a lot of romanticized stories about tarot. And we're going to be fooling ourselves if we try to say that it was nothing more than a game, right? So it started as a game in the 1400s. Occultists appropriated it, and now we use it to be introspective in our own lives as well as assisting others. Have we added to it by assigning additional occult imagery and value? Yes. As a student of Boda, or Builders of the Adytum, and Tarot for over 15 years, I don't believe the origins described by 19th and 20th century occultists at all. Saying that they are the last vestiges of the Library of Alexandria or anything like that. I just don't buy into that. And frankly, I think believing in those things and disregarding the historical facts gives the tarot a bad name. Sometimes I think about the tarot like a psychological Rorschach, and I think I've said that before. Now, like anything else, you know, a tarot deck actually has a ISBN number. It's considered a book, which is why you find them at bookshops. And you'll find a lot of books about the tarot, and a lot of people will be selling their systems. And in my opinion, if you want it at all, is that the tarot is 100% subjective, and that the meanings to the cards are helpful, and that they've laid a groundwork for what they could mean for you, and they help you do some introspection based on those things. And then, of course, if you take it steps further into the realm of the occult, I mean, the tarot and what is ascribed by a card's value and how it relates to you is just the very beginning. So, let's draw a single card. We'll talk about it, what it means, and maybe what it means for us today in a practical, real deal, real world scenario. Sound good? Let's do it. So this is the Nap Hall deck. For everybody out there, I'm going to go ahead and I'll post a picture of the card in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group as well. So here we go. So we've drawn an upright card, so it is not inversed. Many times, people who read tarot tend to ascribe different values, whether a card is upright or upside down. I try not to worry too much about, you know, inversed cards because people tend to make those seem like they're negatives. But in actuality, there's always a positive in every card. So we got the Queen of Wands. Generally speaking, I'll tell you what Knapp and Hall wrote about this card in their white book, which is simply the little books that come with tarot decks. And then I will talk about what the card means in a broader context, and then finally in a practical context. So the Queen of Wands, it's usually just a woman who's on a throne, she's holding the wand. What does it mean? Well, obviously it's a queen, so there's like a feminine aspect to the card. Wands is very much a card, or a suit, rather, that deals with manifestation. Knapp and Hall write just one short paragraph, three sentences on the Queen of Wands. And on the card is a symbol that is not usually put into any other deck. There's a triangle with a vesica, which, you know, is like a... It's like when you see the vesica Pisces, right? They're like the sign of the fish, but without the tail. So like just like the oval with points at both ends. It says, the vesica of creation is penetrating the triangle of spirit from below. Queens correspond to the Hebrew letter He. The card symbolizes the soul's aspirations and the archetypal world of ideas. So what does that mean in English? Well, the letter He in Hebrew, if you wanted to think about the tetragrammaton, Yod He Vav He, but we're just going to look at the He. It is a third-person feminine singular suffix. It's the fifth letter. It's essentially an E, like a Phoenician E. And its meaning is really threefold. It can mean here, as in here it is. It can mean to be disturbed. Or in this sense, because wands are used in a sense of manifestation, it could mean to behold. So when it says the card symbolizes, so the card represents your soul's aspirations, the things that you on the deepest and most intrinsic level, what you want to accomplish, it says in the archetypal world of ideas. Like, what in the hell does that mean? So the placeholder for a realm of thoughts. Maybe this means, in the fanciest way, that you wish to behold in real life those things that you think about. You are aspiring to manifest something. You're on the cusp of a breakthrough, perhaps, in this particular meaning from Knapp and Hall. Cool deck. Not my favorite deck, but it's a cool deck. Let's put it away. Let's think about what this means more objectively, more traditionally, and what it means practically. And as we discuss this, maybe we'll see that Hall and Knapp essentially said the same thing, but in a really poetic and fluffy way. So the Queen of Wands, in my own standard way, is indicative of things like courage and confidence, independence. It means that you are outgoing, and you have determination. It's a powerful feminine force card. Now, typically, the Queen of Wands is seated on a throne. She's holding a wand. There's a flower, usually a feline. It symbolizes various things, right? Which is that there's a throne, usually, that she's sitting on. And the throne has lions that are facing opposite directions. And then there's a symbol of... It's symbolizing fire and strength. The sunflowers that she is holding typically symbolize fertility and joy and completion, or why not completion, but like that you're you feel good about the outcome of something, maybe like satisfaction. And then in her right hand, she has the wand with usually one small sprout that's coming out of it, like to suggest life is returning or it's beginning to manifest something. What does it mean in a practical sense? The Queen of Wands meaning is that it's saying that you're upbeat, you're brave and determined, so you're somebody who's going to push through and get something done. Even if you have what the corporate world likes to call headwinds, or perhaps in a Masonic lodge, maybe you are somebody who is trying to get something done at lodge and you're encountering some difficulty, but in the end, you're going to push through. You're going to see your vision through and it will be actualized. You're an optimistic person. Also, the Queen of Wands says that because of your ability to get things done, it's important that you remember that you shouldn't tie yourself down to the small things, the small goals. Because you're so good at what you do, maybe it's time to be bold in what you want to do. Don't be afraid to go out and do the thing. It also suggests that you are an extrovert. You're a super busy person. You got a lot of connections out there with folks. That you're an expressive person. Maybe you got a lot of tattoos or piercings, or you got a fresh new Masonic ink or something, right? This is pretty cool. And the card also can tell us that maybe it's time that you should think about creating some sort of a group of like-minded people. Does this mean it's time to start a new lodge or a study group? Maybe. But one thing is for sure, because you're so outgoing and you're bold and you're strategic and you follow through, people are going to be drawn to your passion and your enthusiasm about things. And the last thing I want to mention about this is that a lot of times you hear people talk about shadow work or the shadow self, the lesser known portions of your dark side, you know, who you really are. You know, if you think about the iceberg, right? What you see on the top is the surface level, and then what's underneath the water is more the trouble, what you can't see. So when we think about this, don't think about this as a negative thing, right? These portions of yourself are not negative aspects. But remember that a lot of people don't know these things about you. So maybe you have a dark sense of humor. Maybe you have a secret life, you know, something you're kind of hiding from people in the past. Or maybe you're just working on a project that, maybe you're writing a screenplay. Maybe you're learning how to do the longest part in a degree for your lodge and you don't want to let anybody know. I mean, it could just be that, right? Secret projects. What the card reminds us to do is that it says, hey, you know, these things are secret and kind of in our dark areas and we want to protect these things, these parts of ourselves. The Queen of Wands is saying, hey, it's okay to express this side more openly with the people that are in your tight circles, your lodge brothers. You shouldn't be afraid to show your quote-unquote shadow if you would like to. It's really going to enable you to connect with even more people, and because you're going to be vulnerable, you'll connect with them on a deeper and more spiritual level. So that's what we would say about the Queen of Wands. So I will post a picture of the Queen of Wands in the Facebook group from the Knapp Hall deck. I'll also post a picture of the Queen of Wands in a traditional Uphold Pamela Smith's Queen of Wands and put it right next to it so you can see the difference in the cards. And feel free to contemplate both. Again, just my own personal preference, I prefer Pamela Coleman Smith's Queen of Wands more than the Knapp Hall version. However, if that one speaks to you more, then contemplate on that one. It's all good. And if you care to share any insights that this has had for you as the Queen of Wands, any revelations or things, feel free to do so. My own thinking on this particular card, and I'll throw this in the chat as well, is that I am definitely a Queen of Wands all day long, every day. I am somebody who is usually very outgoing. I like to do bold things. I like to channel all my strengths and even my weaknesses to achieve my goals. I'm optimistic with my ideas, and I share them with others, even if they get shot down. And I try to be as vulnerable as possible all the time. I don't really keep any secrets from anybody. My life is pretty much an open book, just a human being, right? So anyway, I'll put that all in the post for the Craftsman Plus. And I will say, before we close it out this week, I would love to tell you about the 2022 Southeastern Masonic Education Symposium, which will be hosted by Hillsborough Lodge number 25 in downtown Tampa, Florida. So the last time I went to this, I was a speaker, and I had a great time, and it was just before COVID hit. In fact, we were hearing about the spread as we were in Florida after the event, having a few cocktails, and we flew home, and that had been just about the last time I had flown for quite some time before the summer happened again. So it was about 6-7 months before I flew anywhere after the Southeastern Symposium last time. Well, they're back. And it'll be on April 9th, again, same place, downtown Tampa, Florida, at the beautiful Hillsborough Lodge, number 25 FNAM. They have a great lineup of speakers. Tickets are $50 plus a $3.50 fee, and they're selling all of their tickets if you go to the symposium's website, which is H, as in Hillsborough, 25, so H25, SMES, as in Southeastern Masonic Education Symposium. So h25smes.org. And it'll tell you a little bit about what's happening there. You can click a link to go get your tickets. There will be Masonic vendors, information tables, food, fellowship, and more. Again, April 9th, it'll be all day. Entered apprentices, fellow crafts, Master Mason are all welcome to attend. Guests must be members under or recognized by the Grand Lodge Florida FNAM and in good standing. They will require a valid and current dues card or a vouchment for entered apprentices and fellow crafts by Master Masons in good standing. You can find out more. You can find Hillsborough 25 on their Facebook feed as well. Now, they have not released all the speakers yet. However, I have the clear to let you know who they have so far. First up, I'm very honored to say that I am coming back. I'm going to be doing another presentation this year, and I'm very excited to be presenting alongside some very esteemed brothers. They've also announced Brother John Nagy, the coach. He'll be back as well, and worshipful Brother Daniel Molina will be there. These are the three that they have announced so far. There will be more. You can find out more. Just follow them on Facebook to check out their stuff, and of course, I'll be sharing all of that information as it is released as well. But I'm very much looking forward to connecting with my Florida brothers and anybody else who makes it down there. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all so much for listening to the program, for all of the support. Thanks to our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for bringing this show to you all for the last almost 11 years. And we're not having any thoughts of slowing down or stopping. You know, we're just adding additional content to meet you all where you want to be in your Masonic journey. So we're making sure that we're covering a wide gamut of articles and history and philosophy. And this is the longest running number one Masonic podcast in the world. And it's all thanks to you guys. I want to say thank you so much. And I appreciate each and every one of you. Before I let you go, I just want to say I recorded this episode with my window open and the fresh spring air blowing through my window in my office. And if you hear a dog bark here or there, I'm sorry. It was worth it to have the fresh air and the breeze. Now, until next week, you all stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition. We'll be right back.
WCY Media.